Hello. Thank you for tuning in. You are listening to ByteRadio.me's Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. For network or show information, visit www.ByteRadio.me or call 843-808-0777. And now, the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show with your host, Robert Sharp. Good day, everyone, and thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. Today, we have a very interesting discussion. My guest is Bodin Wojciechowski, and we are going to be speaking about his book, Zamora Texts, The Year 9000. A lecturer in the year 9000 CE looks back over the analysis 14,000 years of human progress, spanning the development of our ancestors and ourselves, and looking at the development of our descendants. With Zamora Texts, The Year 9000, Bodin presents the lectures of a professor speaking in the year 9000 as he observes our social, political, military, scientific, technological, and space travel progress through history. In his fifth book of the series, Bodin highlights his strong-held belief that world leaders up to our times waste time trying to solve social problems by treating each in isolation, without objectivity, and without taking into consideration the interconnections, physical realities, and other constraints in any particular case. So with that, I would like to welcome Bodin to the show. Good day. Thanks for joining me.
My pleasure. Nice to talk with you.
Thank you very much. Well, you know, I looked at your book and the topics, and this is a topic that's like right down my alley. I love these kind of books that really put forth different perspectives and really cause people to think. So I'm really looking forward to talking with you about today's the book.
Let's see if we can stimulate thinking.
Well, you know, I have to start with, first of all, is it Zamora or Zamora Texts?
It's Zamora.
Zamora, okay. With the Zamora Texts, yeah. How did you come up with this particular format, and what is the, what kind of was the inspiration for this book? And actually, it's a series of books.
It's a series of books. Well, the inspiration comes essentially from a trajectory of my life as I wandered around the world, got schooling in Scotland and in Canada, and then worked in the United States and taught back in Canada at the university, and traveled around the world. My research and consulting work took me to about 40 countries during my career. So I had a chance to look at people in various parts of the world and get a sense of what made their society stick. And when I retired, I decided I didn't really want to continue doing the same kind of research that I was doing as a professional, as a professor. So I thought I'd see if I can distill my experiences and thoughts into some kind of a book. And being a professor, I decided that the kind of book that would best present my ideas is in the form of lectures delivered by a professor. Not me, but somebody more knowledgeable. And
That's the perfect way to frame it. I mean, if that is something that you know, and that makes perfect sense. Now, the Zamora text. What is the meaning? How did that name come into play?
Well, when you read the book, you'll find that pretense is that somebody finds a set of CDs, well, one CD, that contains the text of the lectures that we're talking about, and is surprised to find this CD in his collection, and then tries it on a friend's computer and finds that the friend who's Mexican reads the same CD in Spanish without any settings being changed. So it's kind of a mysterious feature, because they try it with other preset languages and they find that the CD always produces this text in the language preset on the computer. So they copy it in English and send the disc off to be examined to see how this trick is done. But the disc somehow disappears and the text is left in English. And so the text is what was on that disc that appeared mysteriously in this person's possession.
Well, you know, one of the things that, you know, as I was, you know, reading the ideas, you know, behind, you know, that you present, it, to me, it just rang of the idea that, you know, we have had, you know, many previous civilizations that have come and gone, you know, and it seems like this is one of those examples of maybe recalling a past civilization, like the rise and fall of another one, or our current one, you know, and this is like a remnant of that that path.
Well, the texts reveal that the whole Zamora text, year 9000. Is a series of lectures being delivered by a scholar in the year 9000 who looks back at human civilization from the year 5000 BCE or BC, whichever we prefer to use, and follows the developments, the social, the technological, the historical fate of humanity since the year 5000 BC through stages until today's days, and then on from there into the future till the year 9000, where these lectures are being delivered in a celebration of the 10th millennium of our current era.
Yeah, now with the progress, there are a couple times there's a reference to what's called a regression.
Regression.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
I'll be happy to talk about that, but maybe I could start a little bit earlier by telling you how this lecture in the year 9000 sees us arriving at today's period, and why the regression follows.
Perfect.
Is that all right?
Yes. Oh, absolutely. Perfect.
Okay. So he sketches human society from tribal migrant hunter-gatherer groups whose leadership consisted of perhaps the best hunter, perhaps the most physically capable individual in the group. Groups were small, and everybody was happy to be under the leadership of this person who was best at gathering food. From then, larger and larger groups assembled, especially when agriculture was discovered and people settled in villages, towns, and so on. And the leadership of these groups became dependent on some kind of a hierarchy, not necessarily the most strongest or necessarily even the wisest, just some kind of a structure evolved where a class of leaders and their acolytes would emerge. Went on from there through a succession of transformations of this kind of leadership style till knowledge became more widespread due to the printing press and educational institutions. And individuals who were not included in this hierarchy started to develop arguments as to why they should have a say in things. And from this, democracy evolved. Now, democracies, as more recent history, have evolved in very many different forms, but all of them more or less premised on the common man having an input into the decisions of some ruling class. It might not even be a class, but it still is a class too much to a great extent. And this is where we are now. But the problem is that the structures of current democracy are just failing us. And there's no reason to believe that the current structure of democracy is the best government for the future. So we have to think about what is happening to our current democracy. And what's happening is that the ruling class or the politicians or the bureaucrats, whoever you want to identify or not, are essentially leading an economy, a lifestyle, a society in such a way that they gain advantage by spending more money than is available. And when that kind of thing happens, the laws of nature tell you that you can't spend more than you have. So societies start to develop ailments, and we see that in Europe, Greece, Spain, Italy, whatever, where things are reaching the level of insolvency. And the question is, what would you do with that, and what will be the results? At the same time, the democratic liberal ideology says that everybody is equal and allows people to maintain certain lifestyles that are to their liking and not necessarily conducive to social coherence. So there has been a lot of migration across borders and across cultures. And the problem that has caused is that assimilation has become a big problem because nobody feels obliged to assimilate. They just bring their old world into the new setting and cause difficulties that we know of just looking at the So what with bankruptcy staring people and societies in the face, quarrelsome inhomogeneity staring societies in the face, it is entirely possible, and the lecture from the year 9000 projects that there is a collapse of world order, and the collapse results in, the usual things that collapse result in fast killings and murder and disease and destruction of property and treasure. Look at the destruction of ancient treasures in the Middle East of recent, for instance. This kind of thing could happen anywhere, anytime. And if it does happen, the question is how to recover from it. And history tells us that when the collapsed, there were centuries of the Dark Ages, and the period of the Dark Ages where population shrinks, much of the artistic and scientific wealth is squandered, lost, forgotten, and it's not till people kind of come to their senses, if you will, as they did pretty well after the Dark Ages, and start to rebuild society, that the regression is over and we can look forward to new social structures.
So many of the, you know, and what it seems to me is the ideas that you're, you know, putting forth are, so many of the symptoms are really, are ever present right now. You know,
the symptoms are ever present because...
Did I lose you there, Bowden?
There would be more destructive. So is with...
You know what, Bowden, I'm losing you there. You know, Bowden, I missed a lot of that. I'm sorry. Our connection completely broke up. Do I have you here now?
Sorry.
That's okay. Okay. You know what? Would it be possible to have you? Let me have you call right back in, okay? And
okay.
And then okay, great, and we'll pick it up there in a moment. Okay. Sorry about that, folks. Every now and then we have a little bit of a technical challenges here, and Bowden will be calling right back in. Do want to remind everyone, though, you feel free to check out our new updated website homepage, www.biteradio.me. We have a brand new slideshow on there which shows all of the multitude of things that we are now offering, as well as I have added badges for all of our social media so that you can join us on not only Facebook and Twitter, but also Instagram and Pinterest and Google+. So all of those are now available at the homepage. And also, I do want to remind everyone that we do now have a wellness store that you can go in and purchase everything from essential oils to health and wellness products. So be sure to check that out as well. So we should be having Bowden calling in momentarily. And let me go ahead and just play a real quick advertisement here for our lavender essential oils.
Lavender. Did you know that lavender comes from the same family as mint? And back in Elizabethan times, when baths weren't common practice, lavender was used to perfume clothes and bed linen. In the language of flowers, lavender can mean devotion, luck, success, or happiness. Lavender essential oil and its ability to calm and soothe irritated skin is what sold me on essential oils and led me to explore its other uses, like applying to a pillow or to the bottom of my feet prior to sleeping for my insomnia. It's useful for burns, stretch marks, and minimizing scarring. And I thoroughly enjoy combining it with peppermint for an amazing scalp massage and lavender's calm emotional extremes. This essential oil and many other wellness products are available at our wellness store. There you will find information about retail shopping, how to become a preferred member, saving 20% on purchases, and how to become a wellness advocate and shop at wholesale prices with the added opportunity for you to make money. Make your health and wellness a priority today by visiting www.biteradio.me and clicking on the wellness link.
Okay, everyone, we are back again. Today my very special guest is Bowden Wojciechowski, and he is author of the Zamora Text, the Year 9000, as well as other Zamora Text books. So you can find out all of them. They're available at Amazon.com. Okay, we're back, Bowden. Thanks for reconnecting.
Sorry about that, but I knew we were in a weak connection situation.
Yeah, that's okay. That's okay. We can adjust, so there's no problem there. So, as we were kind of talking just before we reconnected, you know, you talked about how, you know, democracies right now, the democracies of the world, you know, are following this, you know, this ruling class kind of path, you know, that ascent, and it may not be, you know, what is needed for the future. Do you have any idea of what a future kind of situation might be, governing kind of situation?
Sure. Well, you know, there is a dichotomy in human nature and the world we live in, and that is that we all individually want to have a lot of room for our individualism, and yet we live in an interconnected world where we need to cooperate in a society. And this has been the problem that democracies have been struggling with. You know, even the communists claimed to have a democracy. They pretended to have elections and so on, because pretty well everybody understands now that individuals want to have a say about how they are ruled. On the other hand, they want to have the freedom to do their own thing, to the extent possible, and the extent possible is the problem. Current democracies in the United States and anywhere in the world have largely tended to loss of individual freedom and gain of authority on the part of governments. This, in turn, you know, eventually builds resentments against, well, you can call it the ruling class, but the bureaucracy, the politicians in office, and so on. You have to read the newspapers and you'll see what I mean. So we need to resolve this problem. How best to apportion rights to the individual and certain obligations and therefore rights to the state.
So now, would it be... what would be a? I mean, because it seems to me that's going to be kind of a balancing act that would kind of go back and forth like a pendulum. That, you know, that there really isn't any one static way of being able to maintain that balance. It seems like it's going to be ever changing.
Well, you know, one of the obvious ways to balance power is to agree to what portion of the national wealth is at the disposal of the state and which portion is left in the hands of individuals. In other words, how much tax in total from all sources, municipal, state, federal, and so on, what portion of monies can be collected by all the levels of government, and what portion should be left to individuals.
Yeah,
and
now,
that should be in the constitution of a state that can consider in future, by referenda or other means, any changes that this split of national wealth is to be adjusted.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned earlier, you know, when we were talking about the tenuous nature of some of the democracies, and you mentioned Greece and France. You know, with obviously with Greece and their debt, you know, and with money being a kind of a crucial factor in the right now in their society, you know, obviously it's creating the social unrest, and obviously, you know, there's the interconnectedness with the international community, you know, is also very important to keep in mind too. So it seems that you know, not only do you have to keep in mind, like for, as far like you mentioned, the taxation of, you know, what is kept in the individual versus the state, but also it seems the international type of interconnectedness financially is also an issue. I mean, you know, when you have, you know, the very wealthy nations, and then you have the, you know, those who are very poor. There seems to be also that can create the tensions as well.
Well, sure. There is no equal distribution of wealth among nations for any number of reasons. Geology, climate, and the work ethic or social, shall we say, attitudes in different regions of the world. However, you know, it is possible to confine nations to live on the budgets that they have. The problem is that they've been allowed to borrow money from others with no assured way of repairing of repaying the debt. And maybe we should you know, find a way to control this. Maybe units of society should be made to live within their means. For instance, in the U.S., many states have a balanced budget requirement, and that seems to work okay. So the federal government could reasonably have a balanced budget requirement, and that would be surely an assurance that they won't go bankrupt by spending more money than is available.
Yeah, that makes sense. Now, you know, with in your book, you know, in addition, you mentioned the regression aspect, but also in the book you present the, I guess, the possibility of a World War III. I mean, you know, you have, you know, the regression, and I can understand with, you know, if there is a collapse, you know, that would very much be created, that might be the environment created. What can you tell us a little bit about your feeling about a World War III, and why you put that in the text as a lesson, a lecture?
Well, yeah, I actually, in the book, see the regression being preceded by World War III, because I believe that you need some kind of a spark to set off this collapse of societies. And I see it as being basically the conflict you see before us right now, with militant Islam, with various disputes, territorial disputes in the East, with old grievances between nations as they are presently formatted. Look at the Ukraine and Russia, and so on. That all these disputes, in the face of discomforts due to government failure to meet their financial obligations, and so on and so forth, you can see that a witch's brew can possibly set off conflicts that become uncontrollable. World War I was a conflict that was set off by a simple assassination in a remote part of Europe. And it got to be pretty impressive as a killing opportunity. World War II also had fairly simple antecedents with territorial demands by Germany, followed by, you know, an expansionist. Germany wasn't the only one with territorial demands. Japan was another one, and it grew into a massive opportunity for killing. So with our technology at the stage it's at now, and I believe that the than it was before World War II. I can see a potential for a serious conflict involving this time pretty well everybody.
Yeah, well, I mean, that, I did notice that you had in the book, the lecture three was, you know, kind of really focused on the causes and consequences, and you know, the all of the present day, you know, conflicts around the world. Now, one of the things that you also talk about is there's a, I'm not sure, it's called the IES and the God hypothesis. You know,
yeah.
Do you mind talking a little bit about, you know, because that obviously would come in after this regression and the World War III. So it's kind of like a rebuilding then of society at that moment.
Yes, you know, the collapse of societies, I think, is reasonably easy to understand because we've had collapses before and you can read about them. The rebuilding of societies is something that has been done on an ad hoc basis in the sense that after World War II, for example, the rebuilding of European societies, of Japan and so on, was modeled on largely an American concept of how a democracy should work. But that particular idea of a democracy was idiosyncratic in the sense of that it was an American idea, and splendid though it is, it was not really dedicated, let's say, towards some ultimate goal beyond this, what is stated in the Constitution. So what I propose is that when the regression is over, we will have to find a more lasting goal for social structures. Now, what would be more lasting goal? Well, we'd have to make societies restructure in certain specific ways. For example, they must be forced to obey the laws of nature. And the law of nature that I think everybody will understand and I've already mentioned is that you cannot live beyond your means or you'll go bankrupt and get into the same problem we're having now. Other laws of nature are that you can't go doing things in nature which will damage the environment, the ecology, and basically the capability of human beings to survive. Because when it comes to nature, I take the position that we have entered an anthropogenic period where man has such capabilities over our natural resources and ecology and so on that we are, in fact, responsible for what we do. And we will be more so as time goes on. So we have to then do things that are naturally acceptable, not things that are just, you know, because politicians think it's a good thing to do.
Yeah, well, I agree with you there that there's right now a huge disconnect, you know, between our actions and the natural laws, you know, of the, you know, of the way of the physical world, and so I have to agree with that. Now, one of the areas you also tackle in the book and is the idea of population, you know, the population,
yes,
increase, and you know, and this is one, you know, I guess. It could, I mean, right now, just the trajectory that we're on and the number of people that we have in this world is, I mean, the Earth can't sustain it. I mean, it'll be a long, it won't be long before we, you know, we won't be able to sustain the population. So would you mind kind of talking a little bit about how you feel, you know, that this is a an area that really we need to pay attention to?
Yes, it connects with the idea of obeying natural laws. You see, we, despite the fact that there are some people who are still worried about overpopulation of the world, I think the regression will trim down the numbers of human beings to a level, let's say, 2 billion or perhaps less at the end of that period. So a lot of the current large population would not be there. And more than that, if we don't breed enough, that is, if each woman doesn't have 2.1 or whatever the number will be at that time, children, then population will continue to decrease mathematically to zero. So we are going to have to control population by actually in future, I think, encouraging breeding rather than discouraging it. And we will have to have policies which would make that a viable option for individuals to take. Because again, the balance between state control and individual thing, individual ambitions must be maintained. So we will have to make it attractive for family units to have an appropriate number of children in order to maintain world population at a stable level.
Yeah. Now, with you know the lectures that are kind of put forth in your book, do you see this as like a real possibility that we can be facing, you know, in the near future, or, yeah, relatively near future?
The World War III and regression?
Well, yeah, that the collapse of democracy.
I'm certainly of the opinion that this is a high probability scenario.
Okay. I mean, like I said, you know, we can look all around us and see, you know, the signs and symptoms, you know, that you put forth, and if you just kind of work it out into the future, you can see that happening. Do you think that maybe there is a way to stem the tide of this? Maybe by looking at some of the models that you put forth in the book as corrective types of actions that maybe people can start to work toward incorporating them now?
The short answer is no, because okay. I don't think the mechanisms, the principles under which we operate at this time make it possible to, for instance, reduce the population of the world in such a way that we don't lose our balance between civilized behavior and uncivilized behavior. In other words, I think that we have gone on the wrong path in terms of social structures, and I don't think anything but a major shock will solve it.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm sorry for those who believe that
no.
I'm exaggerating, but I think that past history says that when societies collapse, a major shock follows.
Yeah. Well, you know, and I was just curious about that, because I know that I think is part of, you know, human history, it's kind of like things don't change unless you're forced to change, to make changes, you know.
Exactly.
And yeah, so I was kind of, you know, and I could see where, you know, there some of these major shifts in social structure could really lead, obviously, would require changes that would then force people to make. So, but now one other area that also that you cover is you talk about space, you know, and space travel and that kind of thing. So let's talk a little bit about that. What you kind of see is now in the book, they of course refer that the professor refers back, you know, to our, you know, space exploits. But can you mind talking a little bit about what the professor in the book kind of states or what you feel might be happening with us in that area?
Sure. I'd be glad to, because you see, the reason that we're, I think, facing a collapse, the reason we've had previous collapses in society and so on, is because human nature is pretty constant, and are to explore and get to know more and more of the world, the universe, ourselves, and everything. And part of this aspiration is, of course, to get off our planet and explore what the moon, Mars, or, you know, those are the things that we talk about right now. I think that this drive will persist. And when the regression is over and we start rebuilding our societies and recovering our technological capabilities, I believe that we will go and try to colonize the moon first. Now, you have to remember that the rockets that we use right now are chemical rockets and capable of very puny payloads to deliver off the Earth. So it's going to be really tough to set up anything viable and lasting on the moon. So I give it some thousands of years before we have a functioning community on the moon. But the ambition after that would be to colonize Mars, which is much more Earth-like in the sense of its duration of its day, of it closer in gravity, although still much lower than the Earth, and capable of being what I call terraformed. Other people use that term too. In other words, made into a habitable world where human beings could exist on its surface without wearing spacesuits and might grow vegetation and have pets and generally live like we do on Earth. But it would be a bit different than things that I explain in the book, the differences that would arise. And so I think that we would expand to both the moon and Mars in due course. In a few thousand years, we should be inhabiting both these bodies. But
yeah,
not,
you know,
with chemical rockets alone. Chemical rockets are really very, very poor at delivering any amount of equipment, people, and so on to these bodies. So we need a new energy source.
Yeah, you know, this is great, because this is the lead-in that I really wanted to explore with you. You know, obviously, you know, you do address energy in some of the lectures in the book. Now, you have your work experience. You've worked in the petroleum industry and also taught chemical engineering. So I am just curious, what is your view of our current energy consumption, the path that we're on with, you know, energy usage, and maybe what do you think that future alternative might be?
Well, one thing that I bring out in the book is that energy is the lifeblood of civilization. Prior civilizations built great monuments and so on using the energy of slaves or laborers or muscle energy. It wasn't till near the Industrial Revolution that we started using energy such as heat energy. We built heat machines. And heat machines are, you know, the internal combustion engine, the turbines on aircraft, turbines in power stations, and so on. We learned how to use heat to drive motors, get rotary motion, and from this, with the concurrent development of electricity, we were able to make energy widely available, and that is really what made our civilization succeed. We'd never be where we are right now, just using animals and human labor. Energy is the essence of progress in civilizations. Now, that being said, it doesn't mean we have to waste it. I'm all in favor of efficiency increase in car engines and lighting and whatever else you want. But even with that, the energy use per individual will continue to grow. If we had 6 billion or 8 billion or whatever is being predicted, people would be an enormous strain on energy. If we have the 2 billion that I postulate after the regression, it would be much less, but per individual, the consumption of energy will grow. And in particular, we need energy to lift rockets off the surface of the Earth and go to the Moon or to Mars. That kind of energy is available only from chemistry now. There are some ion engines, but they're small scale, and really it doesn't solve the problem. The problem is that to get anywhere beyond the solar system, for example, we need energy that is available wherever we go. Now, if you think back, we had energy that's available wherever we go by building sailing ships and not carrying coal or any source of energy, but catching the energy from the environment to go anywhere we wanted to. There was an example of universally available energy that we could use to foster the progress of civilization. We need that kind of energy in the universe to get out of the solar system. Otherwise, we're stuck here. And that's one of the points I raise and propose a possible source of energy of this sort, where a spaceship would just not have to carry fuel with it to go anywhere, but would reach for the energy available in the universe to go wherever it wanted to. All it would need is a large enough spaceship with efficient enough recycling and so on for travelers from Earth to go for generations into space.
Yeah, well, you know, and I agree that, you know, that would have to be the case. What I just don't know what kind of energy exists. Do we know the physics of the energy that really kind of exists out there in space that can be harnessed, like
the
wind that
we
have here?
I guess it's a development that will come when somebody brilliantly discovers it. I have to, in the book, postulate that we capture a phenomenon known as zero-point energy, ZPE. Those who will search the Internet, it is an energy that has been shown to exist in the universe, and it's spontaneous, and it appears everywhere in the universe, in vacuum and on Earth or whatever. It consists of spontaneous appearances of an electron and positron, which immediately recombine, and therefore they do us no good at this point. if we could capture the energy that these two particles possess, not allowing them to recombine wastefully, we may have a source of energy that would fulfill the requirements that I mentioned. How we would do this exactly, I don't know, or else I'd be working on my first $1 million.
Yeah, many, many millions, that's for sure. Well, yeah, I understand. Well, you know, and that's wonderful. Yeah, I've heard about the zero point as well, and that would be fascinating. Gosh, we're down to about a little under 10 minutes here, Boran. And there's one other topic that was in one of the lectures in your book that it was in the lecture that talks about advances in understanding physics. And yeah. You know, just to me, that's a fascinating topic. And, you know, one of them, the chapters beneath that was the discovery of the quote, the fabric. What is that that you propose that the fabric is?
Well, there is currently talk in physics. The physicists at this point have created so many possibilities that that I think we're all confused. The problem is this, that Einstein's theory and quantum theory are not compatible for some strange reason. And people are looking for what may be the connection between these. And some of the ideas that pertain to this or are side issues in this is, what is space? Is space continuous or is it granular in the sense that matter, for instance, water, it appears to be continuous, but it isn't. It's composed of individual molecules. And the molecules themselves are composed of individual atoms. And the atoms themselves are composed of quarks and so on and so forth. Is there such a phenomenon in relation to space and time? And time is another question that's kind of fascinating, because some people believe that time is not really a dimension, but it is a product of our perceptions in some sense. So those issues are before us, just like we don't have a perfect society yet. We don't have a perfect understanding of our universe. And some of this might be in explaining these questions as to whether space is continuous, whether time is continuous, whether time is just a perception or a real dimension, and so on.
Yeah, well, you know, I don't know if you saw the movie Interstellar, but I mean, they kind of, in that movie, they do a little bit of kind of throw in the idea of time and kind of being outside time, and it was fascinating. I think for the general audience to be able to start thinking about time as not being necessarily a reality, or you know, it's just a perception. It's a good way. That movie really was a great introduction into that possibility. But
I'll have to improve my understanding.
Yeah. Well, boy, now in the last few minutes here, Bowden, what is it that you hope that the reader will take away from reading the Zamora text?
I think the readers might, first of all, get some interesting ideas, as some of the ones that we have discussed, but presented maybe more cohesively. And certainly in reading the various other books in the text, you will have expanded explanations. explanations of the things that I spoke about. But most important, perhaps, is I would like people to think about the fact, what is it that's wrong with modern democracies, which we all are proud of but are finding to be failing, and what is it that needs to be done to arrive at a more stable, more lasting social structure?
Yeah. Well, you know, just by recognizing, and because I think many people feel that, you know, or this cannot foresee a democracy failing. You know, the failure of, you know, on a global scale, you know, democracy is failing. So I think that, you know, seeing some of the signs that you indicate in your book, you know, as far as causes and, you know, that kind of thing, or consequences, you know, that definitely would hopefully stimulate people into some kind of action, or at least, you know, questioning, putting out the questions for people to consider alternatives.
Right. Well, I'm a Democrat myself in the sense of believing in power to the people. The question is, people need to protect their power from government. And the democracy that manages to do that is the one that will be successful.
Yeah, pretty much. Well, Bowden, thank you for your time today. I've really enjoyed speaking with you, and it's a fascinating series of books that you put together. So I really want to thank you for taking the time to speak with me.
Thank you, Robert. Very, very nice to have a chance to talk with you and talk to your audience.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Again, everyone, today my very special guest has been Bowden Wojciechowski, and he is author of the Zamora Texts, The Year 9000, as well as others, space exploration and democracy. You can go onto Amazon.com and type in Bowden's name, and you'll see his whole series of books that are there. And definitely go in and read them. Very interesting reading. So, everyone, I want to thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. And until we meet again.
Thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. Be sure to visit our website at www.biteradio.me. That's biteradio.me. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Byte Radio Me. And our shows are also available as a free podcast from iTunes. And until we meet again, remember to be a bright light by bringing inspiration to your world and to the lives of those you touch.